Hello, listeners, young and old, old and new. I'm Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy. Concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Nervously say words, fiddle surprising bed. A mark beneath the chin. Happy 4th of July, a celebration of the time when a group of people rejected government's rule over them, and then they proceeded to set up a new government to rule over them. Almost got it, guys. But you succeeded in creating a system which resulted in the biggest government in the history of the world. The taxes of an 18th century European monarchy would be a welcome decrease in oppression at this point. Today, I'm going to discuss how religion and government often become so interwoven, people sometimes start worshiping their rulers. For the government, this intermixing is a way to justify their rule over others and to manipulate people into accepting their rule because it comes directly from the gods. If their rule is divine, then their violations of their citizens are warranted. After discussing these ideas in more detail, I will talk about a story in Scripture where a ruler required his citizens worship an idol to honor him, and then the heroic response of the three men who refused. In many ancient cultures, from Egypt to Greece to Rome to Babylon, even Asian emperors and semi-modern European monarchs, government and religion were intertwined. Being a citizen of a region where these people ruled often included having to participate in the worship practices of the region. The rulers of these places, and to some extent the systems of government, were frequently portrayed as divine. There are a couple of potential reasons for this. The first is, these governments and rulers have tremendous power over others. They are able to do basically whatever they would like. They lived in an environment of tremendous wealth, regardless of the economic conditions of the citizens of the empire. From the people, they acquired whatever servants, warriors, and women they wanted without resistance. To any normal person living in the empire, their ruler would look like a god. Surely men and organizations this powerful must be divine. The second reason is, these rulers needed to come up with some sort of higher authority to justify their rule. They have to come up with some reason to explain why they have a right to rule over others and why others do not have such a right. After all, they are just human. So what validates their position over other humans? The gods, of course. They have a divine right to rule over other people. This takes many different forms across cultures. Some call their rulers human incarnations of their divine gods. Some simply say their god has put them in this position of power, because if the god of the nation didn't want them to rule, the god would have cast them out of the seat of authority already. Some cultures talk about their emperors and kings being sons of gods. They are direct descendants from the gods, and the normal people are not, and therefore they are superior to their citizens. Some nations claim their rulers are gods unto themselves. If these people are divine in nature, and seen as such by their citizens, justifying their oppression of the citizens becomes much easier. Divine rulers across history are also worshipped. Sometimes they are worshipped directly, as demonstrated in a common custom to approach a throne or a ruler and then to bow down in front of it. Bowing before someone is an obvious sign of subservience and worship. Songs which praise the government systems and the rulers of these systems are also a part of the veneration process. There are cases where these gods in human form were given temples and priests to run the temples, where citizens could come and display their love and devotion to the god king. Often statues or some other created form representing the ruler and the nation they rule were made and worshipped as gods in themselves or as representations of the government gods. Sometimes, the worship of these rulers and governments was mandated by the rulers themselves, but there are other times where it is completely voluntary. When the citizens of a nation grow up in a culture which worships government, it is easy to get sucked into believing in the divinity of the ruler. Children are taught the ruler is a god at a young age. They learn from their parents to honor their government. They learn from their culture about how the ruler protects them, keeps them free, provides for them, and with his divine authority blesses the population. Of course, they would grow up praising his image for the wonderful life living under their God-King's rule has blessed them with. The intermingling of religion and government even happens in some modern cultures. In one such modern nation, there was a group of people who developed this system of government. These people were often portrayed as having the very words and wisdom of the gods when they established the government which enabled them to rule over the citizens of the nation. Multiple craftsmen of the nation artistically designed objects to represent government power, to represent the system of such a wonderful government, to represent the rulers and government's authority over its citizens. They designed these objects so they could be spread far and wide. These representations of the power of the rulers of the nation became prevalent across the land. Children were taught from a very young age to show great respect to the symbol of the state. Their parents and teachers taught them about how the government keeps them free, enables them to live, gives them all sorts of rights, and protects them and their family. Children are taught to see the rulers as looking out for the well-being of the citizens. In places of education, children are also taught the religious practices of the government citizens. Every morning in school, the children and their teachers all stare at the idol representing government, ritualistically perform an act of devotion with their body, and collectively recite a poem consecrating themselves as faithful devotees of both the symbol of the government and the rulers it represents. Religious practices like these, in conjunction with the propaganda disseminated to children in schools, created a near universal acceptance of the legitimacy of their rulers as adults. At most culturally important events for the nation, the symbol of the government rule was proudly displayed and venerated. At the various events which took place at local coliseums, for instance, the symbol was especially revered. Like the idols representing the rulers of old, songs were created which spoke of the greatness of the symbol itself and of the greatness of who and what the symbol represents. Before many of the spectacles taking place at the Colosseums, one such song was traditionally sung by all participants and all spectators of the event. The song was about the symbol and what it represented. Its lyrics were about the majesty of the symbol and the hope that it brings. They were about prevailing in battle against other governments. They were about the superiority of the people in the land who were subjugated under their symbol, and how lucky they were to exist under such rulers. Before the Colosseum event, they had one of the empire's most vaunted singers lead them in worship. The whole crowd gazed upon the physical representation of the rulers, and in unison, they performed a bodily act of reverence while the singer sang the song of their idol. Some people sing along. Others stand there with pride and awe filling their heart. Some even cry. I am, of course, talking about the United States and the American flag. I'm talking about the way most of us, from a very young age, have been taught to accept crazy ideas like the government grants rights. We are free because of the people who rule over us. Government is a blessing to our lives. The American government is from God. The U.S. government has created the best society in the history of the world. The government is our protector. They are our provider. They exist to help us. And the like. I'm talking about the way people look at the flag. They see it with such great admiration and love. They treat it very much the same way people of the past treated idols. They place their hope in it. They pledge allegiance to it. They sing songs about it as a collective. They venerate it, proudly displaying it at schools, businesses, homes, and sometimes even churches. The flag is often treated like an idol. What the idol represents is the government which rules over people using violence and the threat of violence. How can people treat a thing like this with such deep reverence? Flag worship in the U.S. is different than the worship of idols representing a specific ruler of the past. The U.S. flag doesn't represent one ruler. Rather, it represents all of them. The flag represents the system of rulers who wield violence and the threat of violence to maintain their power. It represents the Constitution. According to the Pledge of Allegiance itself, the flag stands for the Republic, which is a form of government that puts a few people in charge of a whole nation. The flag is a symbol of oppression, of a system placing a few men over everyone else. Some people do treat the Constitution as if it were a divine ruler come down from heaven to bless us by his ruling over us. I have had conversations about government where they have said some variation of, I think the type of government God wants us to have is the kind of government the Founding Fathers laid out in the Constitution of these United States. I've heard others say essentially, they think God was responsible for writing the Constitution. They usually forget about the whole justification of slavery written into the Constitution where slaves are only part people. Some treat democracy as if it is the solution from the gods for the problems of government. I've had multiple people tell me, with great emotional fervor, we live in a democracy in order to justify the ruler's violation of their victims, as if a majority vote somehow makes ethical, otherwise unethical ways of treating people. As if legalizing and formalizing mob rule legitimizes mob rule. The propaganda spread by the government and perpetuated by the media, the church, families, and the culture at large has created these conditions. It's hard not to believe in the flag and the government for which it stands when we have been so conditioned to do so. We have been trained to trust a government. We have been taught to see it as a welcome necessity of society, even as a blessing to society. The more I bring up conversations about how the flag is treated, pledged allegiance to, and sung to, and honored so much in the world, the more convinced I become that, at least in some cases, the American flag is treated like an idol. In my conversations with people, just bringing up the idea the way the flag is treated looks like idolatry often elicits very, very strong responses. I get accused of disrespecting the troops. I have even been asked, what is wrong with you? As if the mere suggestion implies I must have some serious issues. And I do have some serious issues. But they have very little to do with me thinking the way people treat the flag looks like idolatry found in the Bible. Recently, there has been a preponderance of people stomping on the American flag. This stomping is a reaction to police brutality and killings, specifically against black people. To be honest, I'm not quite sure what message the flag stompers are sending. I really don't understand what they are intending to communicate, or how stomping on a flag helps fight against police misconduct. Regardless, the reactions to their flag disrespecting actions have been extreme. There have been a lot of social media posts lately about what people want to do to these flag stompers. Some people have suggested killing them. Far more have said outright, they will beat up someone for stomping on a flag. They threaten people with violence for stepping on a flag. They claim a willingness to violate and dehumanize others because they don't like how they are treating their own property. Multiple people have suggested taking those people who step on a flag and shipping them to another country, taking them away from their families, friends, homes, and culture. These are horrific ways to even talk about treating other people. The idol of their rulers has become so near and dear to their heart. These people are willing to sacrifice other people on the altar of their flag. It's a piece of cloth, guys. Those who threaten violence to people who deface it are not treating it like a piece of cloth. Those whose hearts have intense negative reactions to flag stomping or burning are not seeing the flag for what it is, fabric. They are treating the flag like an idol. The radical nature of their response reveals a heart which is deeply devoted to the flag. They are so faithful, they are willing to violate the rights of other human beings on behalf of the cloth. Such devotion looks a lot like worship. A brief aside before I continue. I understand there's frequently a strong emotional reaction when I say things like these. Sometimes people are offended, and I'm sorry if you are. I have no intention of evoking a strong negative reaction or offense of some sort, although I do recognize that that is what happens sometimes when I say things like this. What I am trying to do is communicate my perspective in such a way as to starkly contrast with the typical American way of seeing the flag. While I am quite confident, there are many times with many individuals where the flag is treated like an idol. I am not confident it always is. Can one place one's hand over their heart and say the Pledge of Allegiance and sing the national anthem without treating the flag a nation as an idol? I really don't know. Can one fly the flag with pride without being guilty of idolatry? I'm not quite sure. My purpose is to at least get people thinking about the possibility. For those of us who do think the flag is treated like an idol, a symbol representing the rulers, designed to evoke great devotion and reverence, how should we respond? There is a story in Daniel 3, which I think will provide some insight into how we should act in response to an idol. It's a long one, but a good one. Daniel 3, 1 through 7 says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the blah, 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 and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, tragon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The purpose of the image is clear in this passage. Nebuchadnezzar took personal umbrage with anyone who did not worship the image he created. To worship the image was to, in a very real sense, worship Nebuchadnezzar. To bow to the image was to honor the king, to show submission to him and the kingdom he instituted over them. He deliberately sets up a situation to coerce his citizens into subjugation. Their worship of the idol he sets up acts as a proof of his subjects' devotion and loyalty to him. And he threatens anyone who doesn't honor him by participating in the ritualistic veneration of the idol which represents his power. He threatens them with being thrown into a fiery furnace. In this respect, those who threaten flag stompers with violence are very much like Nebuchadnezzar. Just like him, they are threatening violence upon anyone who does not show what they deem to be the proper respect to the image which represents the power and glory of their nation. The text says all the people and nations fell down and worshipped the image. We will soon find out that this is not quite the case. The point is, pretty much everyone goes along with it. They are so accustomed to the rule of their government and their king, almost everyone accepts whatever sort of traditions their ruler sets up for them without question. The vast majority of the population just goes along with the empire honoring traditions. This sounds a lot like the U.S. to me. In the following part of the text, we first hear about the heroes of our story. They are the ones who think about the meaning behind the act asked of them and decide the way of the world around them is not the right way. Daniel 3:8-12 says, "Therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.'" Again, we find evidence. The king's concern with whether or not the people were honoring the gods of his nation is inseparably wrapped up in his concern for people to honor him. The tattletale Chaldeans appealed to his hubris, saying, "These men pay no attention to you." They understand the purpose of this whole setup was for people to pay attention to the orders of the king. While most go along with the king's quest for glory, there are three heroic young Jews who do not. There are three heroes named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who deliberately disobey the king. Sure would be nice if their names were not so odd and difficult to say. I might even consider them more admirable if that were the case. Nebuchadnezzar, difficult names or not, cannot have such dissent in his nation, so he seeks to rectify the problem of a few people not participating in the nationalistic ritual he sets up. Daniel 3:13-18 tells us what happens as the story progresses. "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this manner. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning, fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So old Nebuchadnezzar gives these three another chance. It's unbelievable to him that these people would go against him and the peer pressure of everyone else who bowed. And of course, the fiery furnace also makes it improbable anyone would disobey the orders of the king. Perhaps out of compassion, or just out of a desire for confirmation to see it with his own eyes, the king provides them another opportunity to bow and demonstrate their subservience. But they don't. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego remain standing. Not only this, but they explain why they won't participate in the customs of the empire. They follow God. So they don't go along with what the world does around them. They will remain standing come what may, whether what comes is social ostracism or being thrown into a fiery furnace. They trust God can protect them and support them. Whether or not he will, they do not know, but they know their job is not to look out for their own self-interest or do whatever the people around them are doing, or to just do whatever their ruler tells them. Their job is to follow their God regardless. They will stand and face whatever the consequences are. When the national anthem is sung or the Pledge of Allegiance is spoken, I know of some Christians who stand up and simultaneously choose not to participate. They stand, but they don't look at the flag. They don't put their hand over their heart. They don't say the words or sing the song. They make sure their hearts are in check and giving glory to God. They make it look like they are participating in the flag honoring without actually doing so. They are concerned about not making others feel uncomfortable or disrespected. I used to do this. I have an empathetic understanding of this response. However, if the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego has something to teach us, this sort of pretense is not the best way. The heroes of this story are not heroes because they knelt down to show deference, but made sure their heart wasn't in it. Their actions weren't honorable because they put up a facade of participating, so it appeared they were participating even when they weren't. They would not even pretend to participate in the cultural traditions of empire worship. These three men were not concerned about their peers who bowed, or making them or their ruler feel disrespected. They had a higher calling. Part of what makes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego so honorable is when everyone else went to the ground and bowed, they stood. I suspect if everyone else would have stood and put their hand over their heart, they would have chosen to sit. As one who is convicted, the flag is treated like an idol. I choose to model these three men in my practice. I do try to avoid being in situations where I might be expected to say the pledge or stand during the national anthem, because I really don't want to offend people. Although in a culture saturated with this practice, I do not always avoid these circumstances. And when everyone around me stands, I sit. When they sing and put their hands over their heart, I pray. I cannot justify even the appearance of joining in on such behavior. My hope is, like the men in this story, God will bless me for my actions. Let's read about their blessings and close up this story in Daniel 3, verses 19 through 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these 3 men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." These men were miraculously saved for their refusal to honor Nebuchadnezzar in the way he wanted them to. God honored them for their disobedience to their ruler, for their refusal to partake in the nationalistic religious practices of their nation. Their boldness, in conjunction with God's salvation, resulted in even the king declaring their God as the true God. I trust, by putting my faith in God and not in the governments of this world, he will provide for me as well. He will keep me safe. He will be close if I face ostracism. He will protect me if I am subjected to any form of punishment for my refusal to live in the ways of the world and join others in venerating a piece of cloth. Even if he does not do so in this life, I will still trust he will honor me when heaven comes to earth in full for acting as a citizen of heaven and not behaving like a citizen of an earthly kingdom when I believe it comes into conflict with honoring him. I encourage you to do the same. At least, even if you still choose to participate in the collective pledges of allegiance to rulers and singing songs to the flag symbolizing their rule, I hope you can show some respect to those who choose not to. They may have very good reasons for doing so. They may even have very good reasons for burning or stomping on the symbol which is so important to you. They are very likely not trying to disrespect you personally, but the symbol to them is not something glorious, but a sign of oppression. Perhaps show them some respect for making a statement in the midst of a world so angry and so reactionary to their actions. As always, I hope you have received something to think about today. Perhaps some things to reconsider. I respect and welcome contrary thoughts and perspectives. Feel free to ask any questions you might have. Please share them with me, and then I will talk about the things you find interesting and not only the things I find interesting. My email address is jeremiahjm@gmail.com. You can leave a message or text my Google Voice number, which is 715-201-2722. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my username is @jeremiahjm. You can find out more information about me and anarchy and these podcasts at www.christianarchy.net. Enjoy your 4th of July weekend. Enjoy the liberty you have been given by the one who obtained victory and freedom for us by dying at the hands of and on behalf of his enemies. I love you. Is that moving too fast? Sorry if it is, but I said it and I mean it. Goodbye, y'all.
To the dark, your words, the melody that carries me.